Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Also, I'm not sucking a dick that just came through a hole in a wall anywhere in Chicago because I have like 18 uncles and I don't know where they are.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is the season 4 premiere with Dan Savage. Yes, the sex advice columnist, podcaster, author of 7 books, and gay ass motherfucking icon. My name is Eric Williams, and it is so good to be back. And thank you for coming back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast after our lengthy winter hiatus. Yes, I took a much-needed break after last year's chaos. There were 6 live shows, a bunch of bonus episodes, and 42 gay-ass podcast episodes. But Fagatrinis, I'm back. I'm back with a gay-ass vengeance. This year, the podcast is bigger, better than ever. Dream guests, as you can see with this episode, and an exciting announcement coming soon about the next gay-ass live show. What is also bigger and better than ever is the gay-ass Patreon. Yes, if you follow me on Instagram, you saw me be a big ol' slut and post a jockstrap pic right after a jockstrap party I went to with my good Judy, Brian Moylan. And Brian is on the Patreon for a bonus episode talking about that very jockstrap party, also Brian's history with sex parties, and some controversy that happened that night where I find out in real time on this episode about one of my crushes and whether they're into me or not. You'll have to go to Gay Ass Podcast Patreon. That's patreon.com/gayasspodcast. And I plan on bringing a lot of guests this year onto the Patreon, including Brian Moylan, who, if you don't know, he is a New York Times bestseller. He is a vulture recapper of all the Housewives shows and just an incredible, incredible, hilarious person. I want to shout out another amazing gay-ass person. That is Zach Noe Towers, who connected me with Dan Savage for this episode. He is not only a great person, but so fucking funny. And if you want to see him live, he is doing his podcast with Kelsey Dara live in New York City and Philadelphia. It is called Confidently Insecure. That's their pod. It is February 6th in New York and February 7th in Philadelphia. So show Zach some love. Go see him and Kelsey, and I'll put the info in the description. All right, it's time. As you can imagine, I was fully freaking out before recording this interview, but the second it started, I just melted in the brilliance and the handsomeness of Dan Savage. Listen for deep talks on family, what it's like living with Dan's husband's boyfriend, and a character actress conversation for the ages. Buckle up. Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast 2024. This is Dan Savage. It's season 4 of That's a Gay Ass Podcast, and my dreams are coming true. Dan Savage, this is a bucket list moment, and I want to thank you for coming on this Gay Ass Fooking Podcast.
And I want to encourage you to have bigger dreams, because getting me to come on a podcast is like...
Stop. Now you're going to make people think it was easy. It wasn't.
Well, it wasn't easy, but like, you know, you should have bigger dreams. You should want Brad Pitt to come on your face or something, not me to come on your podcast.
Well...
I don't want to be too forward too early, but I would much rather have you come on my face than Brad Pitt. But we can get into that later on. Dan, I truly mean I have been a fan of yours for so many years of my life, and this podcast I think subconsciously was born out of that respect for you, and just thank you for being who you are. And I'm going to ask you a lot of gay ass questions, and I know that you're game, and that is again why you are a dream.
I am so happy to be here, and thank you for the. I'm too Catholic to accept these compliments with any grace. So awkwardly, thank you, I guess, for the compliments.
That was a good Catholic thank you. Yeah. That was a great Catholic thank you. I will get into the Catholicism of it all soon. But my first question is something that I want to start because it is the most political of my questions. And it's that Jersey Mike's tweeted, if you were a sub, what sub would you be? You retweeted, said, go get them, kink Twitter. My question for you, Dan Savage, what kinky sub would you be?
Oh my God. I would be all the kinds of kinky subs. I was raised Catholic. I think Savage Love, the column, and the Lovecast have had the longevity they've had because they're not about me or my sex life. I wasn't one of those sex writers who was writing about my own sexual adventures. But everything you might infer about a kid raised Catholic of my age, my generation, being gay, about what my sex life might look like, that's exactly what my sex life looks like.
I would be a tuna melt that gets fisted. I'm kidding. I really, that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, I thought you meant like you wanted to know exactly what kind of DS sex I get into. I'm literally wearing a tied up person on the shirt that I have.
The sub question was quite topical. No, I love the journey of your repressed Catholicism into what you've become. And let's get into that because I am married to a Catholic person who also went to college for theater, who I guess I kind of manifested the Dan Savage life I wanted. But like you had to, I'm sure, break free of the Catholic shame. Was there a very gradual process, or was there a moment where you realized Jesus cannot stop me?
The trick is to hold on to just enough to keep your sex life interesting. People out there who want, you know, to end all sexual shame, I always look at them and go, do you know how much of human sexual expression is actually shaped by, made more interesting and varied by our reaction to shame? And there's something about shame that I just don't think we can heap all of the blame on organized religion, although that is tempting as gay men, right? I think there's something hardwired into human nature and the human experience because of how slowly we develop and because we're consciously aware of sex for a long time before puberty kicks in. And when you think about when you first heard about sex, most kids' reaction is horror. Mm-hmm. Yuck. And you can't believe your parents did that. And you will never do that. And then along comes puberty and you're dragged off into sex after having, even if you weren't raised in any religion at all, 5 or 10 years to be like, ew, gross. And then suddenly, unless you're one of the lucky asexuals out there, you're drafted into this army and you have to serve when you didn't want to serve or couldn't imagine serving. And I just think that makes human sexuality inherently more interesting. I sometimes think it's not that major world religions created sexual shame to control us, although they certainly weaponized it to control us. But in some way, major world religions reflected back at us the sexual shame that we as these human animals that are alive for 10, 12 years before the sex drive kicks in, as compared to, you know, squirrels alive for 3 months before the sex drive kicks in, we are terrorized by the looming specter of sex. And we lie to kids about sex all the time. And, you know, once I was at a college speaking event gig, and this woman stood up in the audience and said that she was 22 and a virgin and really wanted to have her first sexual experience and was too scared. And every time she had an opportunity, she bailed. And she literally asked me, how can I be not afraid of sex? And I looked at her and said, you should be afraid of sex. Sex can kill you. Sexually transmitted infections, unplanned pregnancies, intimate partner violence. We negotiate with sex from a position of relative powerlessness. Sex is bigger and stronger than we are. And that's scary. And so much of human desire and sexual expression and kink is really the eroticization of those fears and living through them as little dramas and playlets. And I think that's kind of awesome. Once you get past the paralyzing sexual fear and shame, once you learn how to like hold it in your hand, and it's still scary. It's fire you're holding in your hand. If you lose control of it, you'll burn down your house. If you keep control of it, you can whip up something delicious.
Well, and also when you're a gay person coming to terms with double shame of like, not only do I have shame about wanting to fuck with the fact that I want to fuck
dudes
a hairy hole, like that is going to be a shocker to anyone's brain, let alone to them thinking about anyone else knowing that.
But how I got past it, in part, it was gay men. I was really fortunate. I'm the rare gay man of my generation in that I came out in high school. And arrived at college already out and was the scandal of the theater department. There was nobody out and gay in the acting program except me, which tells you a lot about what the mid-80s were like, right? Everybody came out.
I'm just picturing like the dressing room for Guys and Dolls, everyone pretending not to look at each other. Sweetie.
And for me, it was, I grew up in Chicago, riding the bus, riding the subway, riding my bike along the lakefront, and I would see gay guys. And I faced this choice when I was, you know, 15 and I went to a seminary for high school because I was going to be a priest. And I had this choice because I wasn't going to be a priest after all. I can either find a woman and lie to her all my life, or I can tell the truth to my parents. And my parents had instilled in me an ethical code that it told me that lying to somebody for 50 years about who you are and misleading them about loving them would be a sin. And so, you know, eventually I went to my parents and said, well, I, you know, put dicks in my mouth and I'm telling you because you raised me right.
Yeah. You honestly, if I may borrow a word from my community, your parents were menches and they used their menchiness to raise a man who said, I'm not going to lie to this poor woman while I'm fucking men at the Hilton Garden Inn.
Although they probably would have appreciated it, you know, my parents weren't, one of the things I had to learn how to do in like my 20s and 30s was kind of forgive my parents for who they were when I was 10, 12, 15 years old, because all the information they had available to them at that time was homosexuality was, you know, something a child drifted into. And if you saw your child drifting that way, you just needed to give them a shove so they would drift in the other direction. And I got shoved a lot. And it was really painful. And it came from a place of love. Like they wanted the best for me. And they had no idea. They didn't have access to any information. They couldn't Google it. There was no Glee. There was no PFLAG. There was no Glisten. There was no nothing.
Yeah.
There was Jerry Falwell and there was Anita Bryant. And then suddenly there was Harvey, you know, there was Harvey Milk. And like some alternate information began to creep in. And it took my parents a little while to come around, but when they did, they really came around.
Well, that, I mean, it's amazing to hear you say that, because I think even though we might have grown up in slightly different times, it's so relatable that you have to forgive your parents for their well-intentioned actions that were quite hurtful. And I think that still, you know, and will be for a while, depending on where you live, especially. Parents who are so well-intentioned, but really shoving in the wrong way.
I always tell people who are having issues with their families, when you're coming out, and it's a best of times, worst of times, you know, depending on where you are, where you live, the community that you live in and who your parents are, almost never a better time in human history to be queer. But, you know, growing up on a conservative fundamentalist Mormon compound in Utah, almost never a worse time to be queer, in part because of the visibility of other queer people.
Right.
Used to be that if you were the weird kid into musicals and baking, as I was, nobody looked at you and saw a pre-gay child. They looked at you and saw a weirdo. Other kids looked at you and saw a faggot, and called me a faggot. But my parents literally thought Liberace was straight, because to think somebody was gay was to think the worst possible thing you could think of a person, and you were a terrible person to think that. And you certainly didn't think that of your own kids. And so what I'm always telling young people, when you come out to your family, give them a year to say every terrible thing, answer every question, let them have a tantrum and love them through it. And at the end of that year, if they can make the pivot, You have to forgive them. There are times when you were 7 years old when you said, I hate you to your mom and dad.
Yeah.
And I can tell you as a parent, that's hard to hear and it sticks with you all your life. You remember it. It still hurts. Mm-hmm. And your parents, if they're good parents, they don't throw that in your face when you're 27. If your parents said some shitty thing to you when you were 17 and coming out at whatever brand of queer you are, you have to be able to let that go. You have to be able to forgive them. And sometimes you have to hold them accountable. You have to say, like, you said this, you said that. I need you to apologize. But sometimes you have to just be like, create the relationship you want with your parents by being their role model.
Yeah. I really think that what you just said to me, I heard that and then somehow in a very hippy-dippy way just said that to the 20-year-old version of myself and really, really needed to hear that because I still bring up some of the things that were said to me. I mean, no joke, this was, again, so well-intentioned, but I had a brother who said to me when I came out, so wait a minute, is the way that you like guys, is that the way that I like girls? And I know that that was a very well-intentioned, of course, kind in a way, sweet question of someone. But he was older than me. He was in college. And I felt like...
And it was more recent than when I came out to my brother and he said, are you sure? And you should give women a chance. And I looked at him and said, are you sure you should give dick a chance? That, I mean, in part, I lucked out by being born into a family where you could argue... and be rude to each other. And
yes, you did.
And so how did you resolve this with your brother?
You know, it took years of a slow acceptance of the circumstances, which were that there were just no tools. I mean, the only gay people or queer people that my family knew was the guy who cut our hair. Like, it really, like, my community, I grew up in Missouri in St. Louis, where there were obviously queer people everywhere, but like my parents' circle, they asked my pediatrician if it was possible that I was gay. And he was like, there's absolutely no way, and God forbid. I mean, like it was just like, they really tried to do their due dill, and yet, really, I mean, like, the stories are endless. And again, I always have to say there is so much love now because my parents are just like yours, where they instilled those great values in me, but didn't know what they were doing.
Can I ask you how old you are? I'm 59. How old are you?
I am 34.
Your parents weren't operating in the same information desert my parents were.
100%.
And so I think you should forgive your parents and get past it. But my God, like, I hear some stories today from people who are younger than me. And I'm like, wait, when you were 15, the internet existed. And yet your parents opted out of the information that was available to them.
There is an opting out. Yeah.
That requires more penance.
And I agree with that. And the last thing I'll say about it is something that it's been a very recent lesson for me, which is to meet people where they are. And it applies to is my family, because they love me. They love my husband. They're so good to us. And I mean, there's so many positive things. And yet, if they are going to ask either a dumb question, or if I think back on a moment that really fucked me up from being young, or like my older brother making fun of how I looked at my nails in front of all of his friends or whatever it was, it's like, you know, there's...
I have so many of those. Yeah.
Of course. And I have a twin brother who said the same thing your brother said. When I came out to him, he said, well, I said my coming out monologue, hey, I don't want to be gay, but I am, and I'm learning to come to terms with that. And he said, well, wait a minute, beat, beat. If you don't want to be gay, beat, you're not.
Well, in some way, he's right. You are going to always be homosexual, but gay is about self-identification and owning it.
Oh my God. Is he a... Is
I don't
he
know
a
if he's gay, but you...
Sex, a sex educator?
I don't know. I'm not going to go into the odds that your twin brother might be gay, because...
Oh, no, I'm not asking. I'm just saying, should he be teaching sexuality courses across the country?
No, because obviously he was engaged in motivated reasoning. He was trying to talk you out of making him have a gay brother, publicly have a gay brother, by suggesting to you that you didn't have to do that, not to yourself, but to him. And, like, that shit is... Man, that's bad. And you remember it all your life. I remember being in the kitchen of my childhood family home when my parents' best friends, who had three kids of their own, showed up for Thanksgiving. This must have been like 1974 or something. I must have been 10, 12, maybe a little older, maybe 15. And their youngest son came in wearing like a little newsboy cap. And my mom said it was so cute. And the dad said, yeah, we got to keep him away from the gay guys now with his little cap. Because, you know, they're all pedophiles and they'll rape him. And I'm standing there going, if they knew. Right? Just like when my dad would talk about agreeing with Anita Bryant and that gay people recruited. I remember my dad gave a speech once. I'm sitting in the backseat of the car, our Chevy Nova. I can remember everything, where I'm sitting in the backseat and it's 1977 or 78, the Briggs Initiative. He's talking about Anita Bryant and he says, gay people are a threat to the economy and society because we don't form families. We don't have children. Gay people don't buy washers and dryers. Is literally what my dad said. And I'm sitting in the back seat. And then...
Wait, can you explain the washer dryer?
Well, you didn't have a family. And so...
So you did not wash a lot of clothes.
You lived an itinerant existence. You lived in an apartment. You didn't invest in a future or a household.
Or you just had to wash your one tank top.
That's right. Can I tell you a story about my mom and when I came out?
Please.
The first thing my mom said when I came out to her, she said, my mom is a kind of a proper Catholic lady, and her pivot was to tell me a joke. Did you hear the one about the two gay guys who attacked a woman in Lincoln Park, which is Chicago's The Rambles? And I was like, no, mom, I hadn't heard. And she said, one held her down, the other did her hair. And I was like, ba-dum-bum. Then we got talking, and she said, I'd never want to meet anybody you're dating. No boyfriends can come to the house, which was a problem because our house was the center of gravity. It's where every Thanksgiving and Christmas and everything was. And my sister, I have two older brothers, I have a sister, her boyfriend, she's younger than me, her boyfriend could come to the house. Mm. And I had a knockdown, drag-out fight with my mother on the Metra train platform by our house because I was just done with this. And I was like 19 or something. And I said to her, like, I know what the problem is. I told you I'm gay and I saw it flash on your face. You see the dick in my mouth. That's all you see, right? You see me giving a blowjob or getting mm-hmm. fucked. Mm-hmm. Laura sucks her boyfriend's dick and you know it. And yet you don't see it. Like you block it out. You don't see it. It doesn't register. I want what Laura's got. I want that, whatever that muscle is that you're able to use to not see, to not know what you know when Laura's boyfriend's sitting at the table. I want the same for my boyfriend. And my
mom. She's wearing an invisibility, not an invisibility cloak. She's wearing an invisibility cock.
Yes. And my mom looked at me and said, the blow, and I wrote this down at the time, and I have it here in my notes. The blowjobs Laura gives could lead to marriage and family and children, and the blowjob you gives lead exactly to nothing. And I looked at my mom and I said, and whose fault is that? Who made that rule? It wasn't us. It was you people, straight people. You decided we couldn't marry, couldn't have kids, couldn't have families. And you enforced that by not letting my boyfriend come to dinner and be anything other than the dick I suck in your imagination.
Mm.
And you have to get past it. And eventually she did. But you had to fight for it and you had to win the argument. And this is sometimes what about younger queers I find really frustrating. You're old enough probably as a gay man to remember who's the woman being asked, who's the woman? You never hear that question anymore. Straight people don't ask that question anymore because we answered the shit out of it over and over and over again forever. Include my aunt once, like, who's the woman? And I got up and I got two salt shakers and I put them in front of her and said, which one's the pepper shaker? Peg, E, neither of them. They're two salt shakers. There's no woman. Like, there's two salt shakers. And we answered that question until they had it through their heads. If you're gay and of a certain generation, lesbian of a certain generation, how do two women have sex? We don't hear that question anymore. They know now. They've seen it on Pornhub. They know what a strap-on is. We answered the question until they begged us to stop answering the question.
And oh, so yeah.
I see young queer people being like, I shouldn't have to educate you. That's not my job. And actually, it is kind of our job as queer people who are randomly distributed throughout the population into the families of non-queer people. It is our job to bring them up to speed one family at a time. And it's our secret weapon. It's why we've made so much progress so quickly. It's why, despite the best efforts of the right, they're not going to be able to, and despite the best, you know, the horrible 500 bills introduced in state legislatures in the last year and the 80 that passed, the groomer slur is passing out of the conversation already. Mm. They invested so much into like making groomer happen. And it kind of happened, but it's unhappening right now because we're out to our families, because we did that work. And you can't escape that work. Each of us, I think, as a queer person, is responsible for the minimum lift of working on your own family. You can volunteer to work on coworkers, friends, people in classrooms that you're meeting in college, whatever. Those are all extra credit. But your immediate family, as a queer person, that's your job. You owe that to yourself and to other queer people to work on them.
Do you also think that a part of our progress is that queer people have proven how exceptional that we can be, that they're like, well, we need them to, you know, design our homes. Like, we got to at least give them some rights.
Paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel at once every 500 years.
Hello. And then I think the tough part about what you're saying is that the lift to teach your family can be sometimes like your mom on that train platform where you are having to be really, really like, how can you not see this? But if they are willing listeners and it's a dialogue and they're not shutting the door in your face, I think that that is...
And you're not going to get everything you want immediately. Like, my mom and I had that knockdown, drag-out fight on the Metro platform. And it wasn't like she was like, oh, you're right. I see your point. Bring the boyfriend by. Now blowjobs are invisible. But like, I planted something in her that forced her to wrestle with the cognitive dissonance and the double standards and also the damage it was doing to our relationship. Like, I was a mama's boy. I was the fag kid. I was home. And we were growing more and more apart because of her resistance to this, which was like, talking about it now, it sounds like it went on for years. It was like 6 months a year. And then my mom just like turned on her heels. And I'm going to cry. I miss my mother so much. There's so many things that have happened in the last 14 years since her death that I really wished I could have talked to her about. But there was just this moment where, you know, the word went out to the entire, I have a huge Catholic family, and the word went out, if you had a problem with Danny, you had a much bigger problem with my mother.
Mm.
Don't put a video up of me crying.
But whatever you say.
But I did that work. And imagine like if I was a queer kid now who like stormed off and never forgave his mother for saying those shitty things about the blowjobs you give. What a thing to say to your son on a train platform with other people around. Like if I tell the story, but if I held on to the resentment and I've held on to the story, it's part of like, you know, my origin story with my mom and our relationship as adults. But I haven't held on to the resentment.
Yes, I'm so glad you're saying that, because if I'm being so brutally honest with you and myself, every time anything comes up about, especially my twin brother or my parents, I immediately get like a Jewish guilt moment of how dare you? And then I realize the second after, it's like I can talk about it because I've worked through it and because it is a huge pivot moment for me to look into what I deserve and what I want to create more of in the world. And if I just, you know, it was always great. My straight twin brother who only played sports loved that his twin brother was a faggot and loved that I would still never stop talking about Effie White. Like, no, he fucking did not get it. So I do, since we are on this topic of mothers, the obstacles, I need to ask you, Dan Savage, the famous podcast question, which is, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
You blame whoever it was that art directed the cover for Leif Garrett's 1978 album. I wrote down the name of the album. I know what the cover looks like, but don't know the name of the album. Feel the Need. He's wearing like shiny lycra pants. You know, he looks like when I look at it now, it's like I feel creepy because he looks like a 14-year-old girl. But I had such a crush on him. And then, you know, my uncles had I grew up in a multi-generational household with like aunts and uncles and grandparents, which was not a way a lot of white people in this country live anymore, but I actually think it's a great way to fucking live when you're a kid, except if you're the gay kid, because suddenly when you realize you're gay, there's just eyes on you at all the time. I first came out and my first boyfriend was like, because it was 1979, 80, it's a different time. He thought it was his responsibility to show me how to like go to the bookstores and, you know, glory holes and public sex.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't want any of that. Also, I'm not sucking a dick that just came through a hole in a wall anywhere in Chicago, because I have like 18 uncles and I don't know where they are at all. I don't have eyes on my uncle and I'm not sucking my uncle off. But my uncles had copies of the Rolling Stone album from 1971 with the crotch on it, sticky fingers, with obviously a dick behind the denim, and had a big zipper. It was designed by Andy Warhol. And now, because albums and album cover art, I don't think are as culturally prominent, they're not a way artists communicate with anybody anymore. People don't realize, like, especially in an environment where porn was scarce, the impact a dirty album cover could have and the ripple effect. Like, 71, I was 7 years old. I didn't see that album. When I was 14, 13, I saw that album and I was like, I want to suck Mick Jagger's dick. Oh my God, what do I do now? What does that mean?
The magic of a bulge. I mean, it will transcend any generation, but thinking of the context of that time and the bulge itself. I mean, I'm eye to eye with it right now. And
so what made me gay? I think those albums made me gay, or they surfaced my gayness or something, or they flipped a switch in a recessive gene that like just turned on the dick hunger.
It's a gorgeous answer. And I think flipping on the dick hunger is a even better way to ask it. You know, what flipped on your dick hunger? And there's something to be said for just like imagery in pop culture, whether it is a book cover, a underwear ad, literally, I don't know if this was the same for you, but if you ever got an ad in the mail of like a JCPenney situation, and not even just the underwear, I'm talking any sort of man.
The Sears catalog.
Wearing a flannel.
When Calvin Klein underwear became a brand and suddenly these underwear boxes appeared in the Marshall Fields and JCPenney's where your mom walked you through the men's department at the beginning of the school year to buy new pants, and suddenly you're confronted with these insanely hot dudes in tidy whiteys in front of your mom. Yeah. I think it's crazy what we imprint on sort of at or right before puberty and how that stays with us. Each of us, I think, do ourselves a favor if we really think about what we're attracted to and why, because we're often attracted to more than we've allowed ourselves to be consciously realized. And you're not doing other people a favor by realizing you're also attracted to different types. You're doing yourself a favor.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, guys with long shaggy hair, like Leif Garrett to this day, snaky hipped, kind of narrow waisted guys in tight blue jeans with obvious bulges and heavy belts, like the sticky fingers cover, to this day. There are just some things that you imprint on that you carry with you forever. And it's a problem for me because gay guys don't have long hair. And there's nothing I like better than shaggy hair, long hair on a man. And where's Peter Frampton? Where's Leif Garrett? Where's Andy Gibb? All these guys from my adolescence, from my pubescence, were sex symbols. And now it's Timothy Chalamet for me, although I'm way too old for him and he's not gay, two problems. But like his arrival, like with his shaggy hair, I'm like, oh my God, it can still happen. You can still have a shaggy haired sex symbol movie star.
Well, yeah, you know, it's going to be back hopefully sooner rather than later. I mean, it's the same thing with, I'm sure all the listeners are going to mouth the words with me, body hair, because they don't stop talking about it. But like, it's the same thing when time of growing up in high school, it was the most disgusting thing you could have had. And I literally hooked up with what I thought was one of the hottest men of my entire life. It was my sophomore year of college. He walked in. He was from Texas. He, at the time, said he was bisexual, which, of course, I was like, wow, he's half straight. That means he's half okay. and then his body was pretty hairless, and he had blue eyes, and you would have thought I just won the fucking lottery. I was like, I'm with my Shiksa goddess, my Shiksa god, and I will never fuck anyone hotter. And then now in my 30s, I am like, if you're a hairless, you know, non-otter, then I take umbrage. I find that I really have now returned back to my roots of thirsting after the businessmen who went to my dad's pharmacy, and I would climb them like a tree in my dreams.
All the guys in porn in the 80s were hairless, you know, kind of muscly toned, but hairless, except for a few. And I always think how there's, you know, for every action, there's an opposite reaction. And we've just witnessed it on the... Remember when Mask for Mask was a crisis in the gay community about five or 10 years ago, and everybody had to very performatively condemn the gay bros? Yeah. Now I get on Instagram and there are gay guys who are hot, who would have been doing the bro thing 5 years ago, who are wearing lingerie, who are at the club rocking camisoles.
Yeah.
And so anytime anybody like identifies something in gay sex or gay subcultures that's gender confining or normative or prescriptive, I've been at this at Dick long enough to know, give it 5 minutes. Yeah. The clones in the 70s were a reaction to the pansies in the 60s, right? The 80s, like ACT UP, renegade, rebel type, were a reaction to the clones who were dressed like truckers and cowboys, you know, dressed like people who hated us. The look that was created in the 80s, like the AIDS activist, street activist fag look, was a rejection of that, but then also had kind of mask trappings. And then along come the 90s, which had a very different sort of reaction. And it's just always this pendulum swinging back and forth. And I just want to say to gay people, it's never a crisis. Give it 5 minutes. You know, if you're into smooth guys, they're out there. If you're into hairy guys, they're out there. But you know what? Your taste may evolve. And it's what is what's being sort of privileged or put at the top of the heap that people want to tear down and resent.
Yeah.
And it's just not worth the effort because it's going to fall all on its own.
And it's also, it's fun to know that while the world's taste will change and your own taste will change, the fun intersection of when those meet. I mean, that is, if we take the drama away, as a therapist once told me, and if we just look at it as like the excitement, I think that's a really delicious angle.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Since we're talking about modern sex in this moment, I recently heard of a turn of phrase that I want to see if you, Dan, have heard of. Have you ever heard of in sex? Have you ever heard of a lucky Pierre?
Oh, yeah. It's the person in the middle during a three-way with one guy's fucking another guy and some guy's behind that guy, fucking that guy, fucking that guy, who's fucking that guy.
Yeah.
And the guy in the middle is the lucky Pierre.
Okay, well, thank you for defining. And why did it take me so long to learn that?
I don't know. You should read my column more closely.
I should be reading it more closely.
Although,
Jesus.
I have to say, I don't think Lucky Pierre has ever come up in my column. I've been in the room for that moment. I have created a Lucky Pierre. I never got to be a Lucky Pierre. But it doesn't feel like a thing people talk about so much. Anymore?
Yeah, I think, well, maybe I'll submit a Lucky Pierre question to Savage Love. And
it's one of those things that's hard to actually, from a structure POV, it can be difficult to make happen. A little like double penetration or some other varsity level sex acts. You got to be limber and you got to seize the moment. And it tends not to be like terribly sustainable. And it's one of those things that porn makes look easier and more common than it actually is.
No, yeah, it seems to be quite acrobatic and circumstantial.
And you need the right, was it Archimedes who said, give me a lever and a place to stand and I can move the world? For that, you really do need the right place to stand before you can move Lucky Pierre's world. It really is about like a bed at the right height so somebody can be on his back in the bed, somebody can be standing in front of that bed and somebody behind that person. All of those things. And then the three people who want to do that. And, you know, for all of that to come together is not as easy as people think, but worth it.
And that is a very good pitch for what to expect and what to hope for when it comes to Lucky Pierre. This episode was brought to you by Big Lucky Pierre. I'm actually paid
what to expect when you're expecting Lucky Pierre. It's the new,
oh my God,
advice guide for wannabes.
That, and talk about varsity sex. Speaking of your amazing sex advice, I have been reading Savage Love for years, and I think it's sort of what inspired me to be as honest as I feel about sex, because I think that when people ask you questions, when you talk about your own relationship to sex, the place of honesty makes other people willing to feel the same. And that's why you can hear a recording of a woman saying, hey, I did anal with my ex and he had a long skinny dick and I loved it. Now my current partner has a Coke can dick and it fucking hurts. Like, that it's stemming from your honesty and your openness.
And, you know, when I first started writing Savage Love, the joke was I was going to give as a gay man sex advice to straight people. And a lot of straight people were like, how dare you? And what could you possibly know about being straight? As if it was possible for a gay person to be as ignorant of heterosexuality as straight people can be of homosexuality. Not possible. But what was interesting, and I think a lot of straight people intuited and I kind of stumbled into, was you can't be a gay person if you're not being honest about sex. And a lot of straight people aren't honest about sex because they're afraid of being judged. I think this is less the case now because there's been a lot of role modeling for straight people by gay people over the last 30 years. But, you know, I told my mom I was gay. I was telling my mom I put dicks in my mouth. I was telling my mom the bare minimum about what my sex might look like. For me, telling my boyfriend I wanted to get peed on or tied up or Lucky Pierre'd, not as scary as telling my mom that I was gay. Actually, not scary at all in comparison. But for straight people, being honest with a sex partner or somebody whose opinion of you matters, that you're invested in, is terrifying. As gay people, we had to do that first. Before we could have a relationship, we had to tell the people we loved something about us that felt scary to share.
Yeah.
And then you like sail into relationships. I'm not saying there's not like kink shaming in gay land, especially 40 years ago when I came out, there was a lot. I'm just saying, once you've stared down at, as a teenager, telling your parents you're queer, being honest with your sex partners, that's why gay people were always out about being in open relationships.
Yeah.
Despite the way people would judge that, including some other gay people. It's like, fuck you. My mom knows I put dicks in my mouth. I don't care that you don't like that my husband and I have three ways. You can go not have three ways with me and my husband.
Well, I'm sort of right now seesawing in my mind about how I completely agree with you. And then the other side of my brain, it's like, well, I found that I try to acclimate myself so much to being, yeah, I'm gay, but you don't have to worry about me, that I think sometimes I would internalize that I need to behavior. And I'm in a part of my adult life where, to give you short context, I only really had a straight community of friends in my 20s. I moved to LA 2 years ago from New York, and I have a like gorgeous community of queer people here that have really sort of accelerated my growth and how I view myself. And I now can remember moments where I've always talked about my own sex, absolutely. And I've sometimes inspired my straight friends to talk about themselves, but I can see the terror on their faces when it comes up. And I think, to bring this all full circle, is that I do think sometimes I feel that ping of terror if my mom listened to an episode of this podcast where I talk about my husband and I fucking other people. You know, like, there is that, like, I want to stand in my truth, and I do for the most part, but it doesn't stop those pangs of pure terror.
And aren't they, once you can't defeat them, but you can contain them. In a way, they give a kind of texture and spice to life. Like, if you never felt that, in a way, the sex you have, the person you are sexually, it wouldn't feel as hard won and as valuable if there weren't occasionally these moments where, I don't know, like, to be perfectly honest, I wrote this in one of my dumb books, but there is some meaning at the heart of heterosexual intercourse that is denied us because of conception, right? And I feel like we can acknowledge that and grieve that. And also bear in mind that straight people, most of the time when they have sex, are desperately trying to avoid conception. Mm. They're not running at it. There's a reason we all have sex. It's not about making babies, even if that's what our lizard brains think we're doing when we're fucking some guy in the ass. Sex is about connection, intimacy, the pair bond, whether you're pair bonding for an hour or pair bonding for a very long time. And all of those things have meaning. But every once in a while, I'm just like, this moment of existential sort of, the void opens in front of me. And I'm not defeated by it or dissuaded by it, but I kind of can stand in awe of it and acknowledge the mystery of it and not feel diminished. And I think that's an important ability. I think we all have to learn how to do that as queer people and straight people.
Oh, yeah.
Because we're lied to about what sex is, what sex is for. We're told it's for making babies. And all around us is the evidence all the time that that's not why people do it. 99.99% of the time. Even if you're Michelle fucking Duggar, 99.99% of the time, it is not to conceive. It is for all of these other things that are, that give human life meaning.
Does that influence at all if you are so frequently talking about sex and, of course, shame? Does it at all affect your personal taste? Because reason I ask this is that I have been a fan of also Hump, your film festival, and I was looking at the lineup for this year, and there's a movie that's basically comes to life, comes to life a fantasy about booking an Airbnb, and then when the guest arrives, then of course fucking happens, and sounds very delicious to me. A part of that, I think, that I love so much sort of translates to my massage thing, which is that I don't, I, of course, sex work is work, would love a Rent Masseur moment. But there's another fantasy of mine that's a part of that, which is like, no, it's a fully like above board massage that organically goes there. That to me is kind of like A plus, we love. For you, Dan Savage, does how much you're talking about sex, facing that void, does that at all change or shape your personal taste?
I have no game. I have, I recently, during the pandemic, somebody wrote me that I used to know like 20 years ago, 25 years ago, maybe longer because it was before Terry, who was just like, I threw myself at you and I had no idea.
Wow.
And so nothing ever escalates for me. Like it, nothing just like kind of organically proceeds to sex. What happens for me is like, I look at somebody and go, wait, are we flirting? Because if we're flirting, I'm like totally into flirting with you. Like, I'd love to have sex with you, but I literally can't tell.
Wow.
I am dense. I am like deaf to it.
I'm jealous. In a way, I'm jealous because
I shouldn't use deaf in that way. I'm equating deafness with denseness. I just, so I'm going to say I'm blind to it. No, I can't, like, I don't have the receptors. I can't pick it up. But when I get a sense that somebody's flirting with me, my pivot is always to start talking. And for me, talking and negotiating consent is a kind of foreplay. It doesn't have to be unsexy. Mm-hmm. So I could never be in a, if I was getting a massage and it started to proceed that way, I would like interrupt and be like, I have no expectations here. Like if you thought that you had to give this to me to like get a tip, I was already planning to tip you. Like I would start babbling.
Is it your Midwesternness? Is it a politeness?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a politeness. Also a deep sense of like, no one could actually be attracted to me. Like, this is not actually happening.
How can I prove to you that I have thought you were very handsome for years and years and years and continue? And again, don't worry about taking this compliment because don't be a polite Midwesterner. Just sit in it for a second. For many years and for many years to come, will me thinking you are one of the most handsome men.
Oh my God.
Will be the truth. And don't say thank you, just take it in. Okay, I want you to just take that in. Okay, so...
my entire emotional immune system is rejecting this.
Everybody, he is fully shaking.
I look like one of those right-wing women in the, like, I got the vax and now I have tremors videos.
You're having tremors because you just received a very forward compliment from a gay man on a podcast. Yes, and yes. At least I'm happy. At least you know you're alive by the anti-vax tremors. Yeah. Dan Savage, I need to ask you another gay-ass podcast question because it's in my contract. If the world was ending, you could only save one character actress, who would you save?
Well, Margaret Hamilton and Suzanne Plachet are dead, so it's late.
Well, okay. If you want to bring anyone back, if you want, you can, but continue on this journey. I'm with you.
I'm sure every other guy or plenty of guys who've answered this question have answered Jennifer Coolidge. So she's saved.
She's been saved.
So I'm going to go with Carol Kane from Taxi to Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah.
One of my favorite character actresses. Nobody I want to spend time with because it's so clear from the sound of her voice that she smokes a lot, I'm guessing. And I can't stand being around cigarettes. But I want Carol Kane to always be in the world because I love her performances, her vibe. I just rebinged Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. I'm going to commit a thought crime here and say I like it better than 30 Rock, which I also love. Love Jane Krakowski on 30 Rock.
Love Jane Krakowski, but you will... Yeah, you'll have some gays after you. But listen, we love... Stand in your truth.
And so Carol Kane. I want more Carol Kane.
Do you know how topical you're being right now? Because I literally read a headline 2 days ago that she's getting all this buzz at Sundance.
For what?
So it's either at Sundance or just all these... there's a new movie coming out. It's a very Jewish movie, which, hey, I'm very into. And it's basically about... It's Jason Schwartzman and Carol Kane. It's like an offbeat Jewish comedy where they... Schwartzman plays a cantor in crisis, and Carol Kane, the adult bat mitzvah pupil, he grows smitten with. Okay,
oh my God, I would love for Carol Kane, if there's buzz, to get an Oscar. She deserves the totality of her career. You look at her IMDb, and she's been a working actress for 40, 50 years now, and She's amazing.
Oh, and my God. It's, and by the way, like a very, your answer is so informed because you took us through our Wicked Witches of the, what was Margaret Hamilton? Of the East? The West? You're taking one of our, you're taking our Wicked Witch and acknowledging her in the ground. You're taking our Jennifer Coolidges and you're giving us even a Jane Krakowski mention. And then you're landing on Carol Kane. It is a tour de force of faggotry, and that you should feel very good about.
Well, thank you very much. And I have a rabbinical student story that I will share with you when we stop recording.
Dan, you are giving me a gay-ass Jewish tease, and you know straight away.
You're going to love this story, but it is not one I will ever tell when I'm being taped.
Okay, okay, okay. Well, I'm going to hold you to that the second. Actually, let's finish now. I'm kidding. Well, I'll make sure to ask you. We've been recording for 10 seconds. Okay, so that is delicious, delicious, delicious. Because you did bring up your very gorgeous husband as well, Terry Miller. Can you give us a bit of an insight into what your relationship is? And this is a selfish question, but I do think people get something out of it. Of you having a relationship, a marriage of so many years that people know that you are fucking other people, that people know certain truths about you. They know that they've seen your husband on the internet, gorgeous photos. They see these things that a straight couple would be like, oh, those are intimate parts of my life. What is your relationship to that public versus private part of it?
Well, first of all, I should back up and like just said, I have no game. And yet somehow Terry is my husband, right?
Yeah.
And it was because I was at a bar and I pointed at that guy and said, oh my God, he's so gorgeous. Not to him, but to a friend. And then he walked up to get his coat from Coat Check right next to other, my friend was working Coat Check. And she, Ginger Vitus, Seattle Dry Queen, said, tell him. Stop telling me, tell him. And I never would have spoken to him in 100 million years.
Say the drag queen's name again.
Ginger Vitus.
Ginger Vitus, we love you. And wow, that, I mean, doing the goddess's work.
But Terry and I kind of accidentally backed into being, I'm really glad we've always been out about being open. But when I wrote The Kid, which is my memoir about us becoming parents, we were monogamous at Terry's insistence. Mm. And I said that on like page 3. Mm. When I wrote The Commitment, which was about our decision to marry practically a decade later, we were no longer monogamous. And I felt that we were now trapped and I had to be honest about it because, you know, the gay marriage equality debate, the marriage equality debate was roaring. And there were a lot of people out there who were saying, like, why shouldn't monogamous gay couples be allowed to marry? Hmm. And my feeling was monogamy is not a standard we hold straight couples to. They can get married and not be monogamous. We want equal rights, not double standards. Hmm. But also, like, we could be outed as non-monogamous now. And people would claim that we lied to when we were adopting, or I lied in that book. So I had to tell the story of how we grew into a non-monogamous relationship because I had trapped us, because I had no choice. I'm glad we've been out, you know, we've been together almost 30 years, non-monogamous for 25, 26 of those years. I can't tell you the number of times I've had people, including some gay people, tell me that they couldn't do what Terry and I do, have an open relationship, because they value commitment too highly. Those exact words. And they're like, how many fucking decades do I have to be with this man before we get credit for commitment?
And
like,
to show that you value commitment.
And the next thing out of a lot of these people's mouths after, could never do that, I value commitment, all of my marriages were monogamous. So I've divorced one person after another because what I'm married to is monogamy and not,
you know,
anybody.
My third husband. Yeah.
Yeah. And how do we deal, like, I know this will seem crazy to anybody who's encountered Terry on Instagram. He was once very shy, and there was a joke on Queerty or Toll Road back in the day that I had made Terry up because there were no photos of Terry on the internet except for one of him in a fake mustache at Halloween holding our dog. And there was nothing. And now, of course, Terry, you know, is one of those Instagram exhibitionists, and more power to him. He has a boyfriend. I have a boyfriend. We live together in Seattle, me and Terry and his boyfriend. I spent half the year with my boyfriend in an undisclosed location.
Compound.
Yeah. And how do I feel about, like, I sometimes there's a lot of people out there who are poly proselytizers, and I kind of loathe a lot of them because I reject this idea that, you know, to be polyamorous is to exist on a higher emotional plane, mm-hmm. or to have evolved or matured in a way. It works for some people. It doesn't work for other people. As poly people or as non-monogamous people, and we didn't set out to be poly. Eventually we were just like, well, I guess this is, we're acknowledging the facts on the ground here. Like Terry and I are, our lesbian friends used to joke that Terry and I together were one lesbian because anytime we had a very special guest star, we called them, we would be messing around with one guy for a while, and then we would kind of be boyfriends with that guy,
yeah,
and get a U-Haul. We're one lesbian, and so we kind of have relationships. And I was never the, I reject the idea that demisexuality is a sexual orientation. I think if gay people can do it, straight people can do it, lesbians can do it, and gay men can do it, it's an activity, an inclination, a preference, a relationship model. I don't think polyamory is an orientation. I don't think demisexuality is an orientation. And I say this as somebody who's like, yeah, that's kind of me. Like, I kind of got to know somebody. Sometimes I could get to know someone well enough in like an hour, but to actually be fully intimate sexually, I kind of have to have a relationship.
Well, it's, I think in a way, my question was almost a projection of, the real question probably underneath it was, well, how do you deal with if a straight couple or gay, but usually a straight couple is projecting their judgment onto you? I think that's...
Is it a straight couple that matters? You know, we live together in a Catholic neighborhood in Seattle. We're a couple of blocks from the big Catholic private grammar school. Mm. So a lot of our neighbors are Catholics with kids, and we tumble out of the house as our gayest selves. And like, if they have, somebody has a problem with it and they're not making it our problem, we could give a flying fuck. The people we care about, except my husband's boyfriend, Tom, is a member of our family, and my boyfriend, Joe, is a member of our family. And it's fine. It's fine. And we're not out about it to make a point. We're not out about it to win, you know, any contests. I reject poly people who point at monogamous people and say, you're doing it wrong. Yeah. With the same fervor, I reject monogamous people who point at poly people and say, no, you're doing it wrong. And it's usually the monogamous people who say it to us, or who say, like, that can't be love and you're doing it wrong. But some polyamorous or open people turn around and like, no, you're doing it wrong. That's bullshit. In some ways, even if I hadn't trapped us by talking about us being monogamous in my first book, probably would have come out about it, just because we have, it's a terrible thing. If you've ever been a gay man and you've dated somebody who's closeted, you're dragged back into the closet.
Oh yeah.
If you're somebody and you're dating a married couple, or you're dating one half of that married couple, and you have to be a secret, you're really being dragged back into a closet. And that's not fair to that person. It's not fair of a couple to ask somebody that, that of somebody. And so, you know, when we first started, when our regular guest star, like a third, progressed to more of a boyfriend, you know, what were we supposed to do at Thanksgiving? You can't come because our parents are going to be there. You can't come because people will realize. So you have to be exiled. Like, that's the cost of being with us, is a kind of diminishing emotional exile and being closeted. Like, that's not, I think, something you have a right to ask of someone.
Absolutely. And I think that it's a testament to it being something organic that then leads to, again, realizing that leaning into a shame of anything only punishes you and every single person around you.
Terry and his boyfriend Tom and I were just at I never go out to the clubs. I'm too old. I never wanted to be, you know, the 59-year-old guy in the gay bar full of 20-year-olds, but like, Terry talked me into it. I went out, and literally somebody came up to Tom and was like, do you and Dan get along?
And can you imagine, like, the drama of every day is hell in your house?
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's a relationship. Tom and I have had fights, and we've had to, like, hammer out, like, how we live together. But that's true of any relationship.
Of course. Yeah, I just can't say enough that the honesty is it's helpful to me. It's helpful to everyone, and it's.
Remember when I said I grew up in a multi-generational household?
Yeah,
I actually kind of think my childhood, and this is just occurring to me now, put me in good stead for the kind of relationships I have now, because you know my aunts and uncles, cousins, grandparents, people weren't sleeping together. There was no incest, no incest fantasies, nothing like that. But there was a lot of like. Sharing space and negotiating like these intimacies, not sexual intimacy, not romantic intimacy, but really like it was a crowded house. And that for me felt normal. And so when, you know, I'm here, Terry's here and his boyfriend's here and my boyfriend's here and the dogs are here and friends are over, for me, that feels very much like home. Again, with the caveat that nobody in my family was fucking anybody else in my family that they're related to by blood, just marriage. Still, like a crowded house, it to me, that is very comforting.
I love that. It's just like you're having your 13 aunts and uncles over, but instead of that, it's you and your 12 boyfriends. Yeah. Well, listen, Dan, I have to sadly end this episode, but I am undeniably thrilled and just so happy that this happened. Before we say goodbye, though, I am going to ask you a final question that you were not prepared on. But it's going to be something that we're going to work through together. It's the first time I'm asking this for this new season of this podcast. But what was the straight movie that turned you gay? For me, it was either Speed or Mars Attacks. Feel free to take a second.
Oh my God. Cruising with Al Pacino?
Delicious.
Yeah, I'm just going to go with Cruising.
A gorgeous answer. And before we officially sign off, Dan, where can people find you? What would you like to let them know?
Well, everything about me, all my shit, is at my website, savage.love. You'll find Savage Love there, my column. It's been running for 33 years, which is still syndicated. It's still in a bunch of newspapers. And you'll find the Savage Lovecast, which is now 17 years old. I just recorded my 900th episode of the Savage Lovecast.
Wow.
And my books are there, and Struggle Session and Savage Love Live. You can subscribe. You know, everybody's got a Substack. Savage Love is kind of my Substack. And you get all sorts of extra goodies. But, you know, I was recording the column or recording the podcast for years. And then rather than pull it back, we doubled the length of it and let people who wanted more buy more. And when I pulled the column onto the website, I doubled the length and now people can subscribe if they want twice as much Savage Love. But I didn't take any away from people who've been reading it basically all of their lives now. So there's still as much free Savage Love as there ever was. And if you want a little extra Savage Love, you can subscribe at savage.love.
Yeah, be one of those magnum subscribers, and obviously
be my sub. What could be hotter?
Hello. Well, I am going to put that all in the description, and Dan, I cannot wait to hopefully see this handsome face again. Thank you. Wow, did I flirt or did I flirt? Thank you for listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast with Dan Savage. And if you enjoyed that, let me know. Tag me on Instagram at Eric Wills and the podcast at Gay Ass Podcast. And hey, tag Dan Savage and let him know that he needs to come back on. I got through a lot of questions, but I could talk to that man for days, and hopefully I will get to see him again. If you enjoy the podcast and you want to help us continue, click the 5 stars review and leave a review yourself if you feel inspired to. And that will help us get to the 300 review mark on Apple Podcasts and whatever it's at on Spotify and elsewhere. I cannot wait for more episodes. And if you would like to listen to another episode right now, just go to the Patreon, patreon.com/gayasspodcast for a episode that is not safe for work. And I will never post on the main feed because I'm talking about some non-monog jockstrap party realness with New York Times bestseller Brian Moylan. $5 a month, bunch of bonus episodes there and more. And I'll see you next week for another incredible guest. Subscribe, live, laugh, love. You're gay.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.